by traffic this morning, so I appreciate your being here and on time, and out of respect for you and your efforts to get here, we'll start right now. And Mr. Nord, Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue, is here to begin a presentation on Minnesota's property tax system. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the record, my name is Jason Nord. I'm a state program administrator director at the department. I work in the property tax division, and I primarily work with county auditors and treasurers on topics that include levies, aids, credits, tax calculation, TIF, forfeiture delinquency, and data reporting. And I'm here with Andrea Fish, who works more with the assessors, and we'll cover some of the assessment portions of this overview. And we'll be followed by Eric Ouellette, who you met last week, our property tax research director. I'll start with taking a look at what the administrative structure of the property tax system is. As I said, property taxes are different from the other state taxes in that they're administered largely locally by the 87 counties. And there are three major offices that are involved in the administration of property taxes. The assessors, who deal with all the valuation of property, the classification of properties, and different program eligibility. And then the auditors, who play a very large role in combining levies, calculating rates, calculating the taxes and the credits, overseeing the forfeiture of property, and treasurers then, who work with the collection, the penalties, the interest, and the settlement of the funds. At the Department of Revenue, we provide largely an oversight role along with some education and a little bit of direct administration. We are involved with equalizing local assessments, and we do that through the State Board of Equalization, through sales ratio studies, by answering questions from local assessors and local officials, and providing bulletins on topics to try and create some uniformity. We also monitor compliance. We do this through data collection, and we have some regional reps who work directly with the counties and assist them and help monitor their how they're implementing the system. We license assessors. We do a lot of education and training of assessors, auditors, and treasurers. We have the research function that includes producing reports, doing revenue analyses, and forecasting. And then we directly administer a variety of programs. We do state assessment of some property types, some utilities, railroads, air flight property. We calculate state tax rates, make state Sustainable Forest Initiative Act payments and administer that program, calculate all the state aids and pay the aids, and administer deeds for tax forfeited lands. Next, I'd like to take a look at kind of the overall time frame. The property tax system is generally set up on a two-year cycle, but it spills over into a longer time frame. So generally, we refer to property tax years by the assessment year / payable year. So in this example, for assessment year 2011 or taxes payable in 2012, most of the activities occur during those years, but it does spill over a little bit. Some of the assessment work actually begins earlier on. The sales comparison period that helps establish the values for 2011 really occurs from the end of 2009 through most of 2010. And a lot of the valuation work that assessors do is done in advance of the assessment date throughout the previous calendar year. So the values are set, though, as of the assessment date, the January 2nd, 2011 assessment date. And then there's time allowed for the appeals, for the review and the appeal and the equalization of those values. So valuation notices are mailed to taxpayers. Local, county, and state boards of review take place. And generally, values become mostly final by July 1st of the assessment year. During that time, local budgeting activities have started, and then the levying process kind of fills out the rest of the assessment year, where by August we certify aids. That lets local governments establish preliminary levies, engage in the truth and taxation process, and adopt final levies by the end of the year. That transitions it then into the payable year, where taxes are actually calculated, tax statements are mailed, and taxes then are due in May and October for most people. The credits that were calculated get reported to the state. We pay those aids and credits mostly at the end of July and the end of December. And during the latter part of the year, taxpayers are also filing for property tax refunds, and we pay those refunds. Then once you get past the payable year, that's when the delinquency process starts. And eventually, if people are delinquent for 3 to 5 years, property forfeits to the state. So there's a lot going on in the property tax system, a lot more than what the typical taxpayer's perspective might be. The typical taxpayer's perspective might be rather straightforward. You think your tax should equal your value times the tax rate, and that the taxes you pay then are those initial taxes calculated net of any credits, and ultimately your net tax burden is what you've paid minus any refunds that you get. However, this more simplistic outlook of the property tax system does create some misconceptions because there is a lot more going on and a lot more factors at play. One of the common misperceptions is that jurisdictions adopt property tax rates rather than levies. And so people might think if their values are going up, their taxes are going to go up. And Andrea is going to get a little bit more into some of those misconceptions about the relationship between value and tax. It's not as direct as one might think it is. So aside from the taxpayer's perspective, the taxing authority's perspective is a little bit different. Taxing jurisdictions don't adopt rates, they adopt levies. And so when they decide what levy to adopt, it's not necessarily an automatic calculation of a need versus minus any aids and other revenues. They generally have to balance what amount of aid they're going to get, what amount of other revenue sources that they have, and what the demands are for services. So it's a difficult calculation that goes into establishing what the levy should be for a local jurisdiction. The tax base, though, is just the sum of all the values, and the rate is mostly a mathematical computation and isn't really significant in and of itself, although it can be a measuring stick. But the rate is just whatever you need for the levy to be spread over the tax base, and it's really the tax base that drives how that levy, the burden of that levy, is passed on to taxpayers. But there are some common misperceptions among taxing authorities. Some people may believe that when there's an aid cut that automatically impacts a levy, but it isn't necessarily a direct relationship. I think some of that goes back to the days of when we had HACA, and when HACA was cut, there was actually a direct relationship between levies and aid cuts, but it's now more of a decision point and a more complicated calculus.
Mr. Nord, can you hold for just 1 second? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nord, by the way, that angle line was a great graph. But on this one, what the tax base is that net tax capacity or market value, and how does that play into the tax base calculation?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, it's an excellent question. This is talking in the more generic sense, so it's true of both. You would take your referenda levies or the levies that are subject to the referendum market value tax base and make that calculation for that rate, and you would also be making the calculation of your more general purpose levies, which are spread on the net tax capacity. So as we'll be getting into in the coming slides, how you define your different tax bases and what levies you apply to those tax bases really impacts how Minnesota's property tax system is working. So,
thank you.
The last couple of misconceptions is I think people tend to think that if, you know, just like a taxpayer might think if their value goes up, their tax might go up. A jurisdiction may think that if their tax base is reduced by classification changes or something, that might automatically reduce their levy capacity. But too many people may focus on rate comparisons, comparing rates across jurisdictions, whereas the key really is focusing on the levies and the amount of levying you're doing for the amount of services you're providing. So the more global perspective then is that of the state lawmaker or the state policymaking perspective. There's several policymaking roles that the state is concerned about when establishing and defining a property tax system. The first global role is defining the taxable value or the structure of the tax bases that really assign the relative tax burdens across different types of property. After you've established your taxable values and how your tax bases are structured, you need to determine who you're going to give levy authority to and to what extent you're going to grant that levy authority. Then you also provide aids to local governments in recognition of state mandates or as a way to equalize revenue-raising capacity across jurisdictions. and to further fine-tune the fairness of the system that you've established in setting up the tax bases, you provide additional relief directly to taxpayers through credits and refunds. And finally, you establish the processes by which taxpayers can have input, in which they can review and appeal their values, and values can, and taxes can be equalized. We'll cover each of those major roles as we kind of overview the Minnesota property tax system. And so the first global role is to define taxable value. And there are actually several different ways that values and tax bases are established. Questions lawmakers need to consider is what property should be made taxable or what should be exempt. How should the property be valued? What's the appropriate valuation process for determining the value of property? And then, more importantly, how is the taxable value structured? So, in other words, what special value deferments or exclusions do you want to employ to reduce the taxable market value from the full estimated market value? How do you want to classify property? What class rates do you want to apply to those properties to yield the net tax capacity, which is the main tax base in Minnesota? And then what other tax bases and levies do you want to authorize? And so from this point, Andrea will discuss more the valuation process.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Tax Committee. My name is Andrea Fish. I am also with the Department of Revenue. I'll cover today just a little bit of the assessment practices, the valuation and classification components of the property tax system. If we start with the valuation process, which would come first on the overall timeline of a tax year, the three most common valuation methods that are used by appraisers are a sales comparison approach, an income approach, and a cost approach to property. There are three different ways of looking at a property to determine a value for any given property. I will get into the fact that the assessors most commonly use a sales comparison approach, but before I get into most local and county assessors, I will briefly touch on the fact that there are some properties that are assessed by the Commissioner of Revenue. We refer to these as state-assessed properties. These include air flight property, where the taxes go directly to the state in that situation and not to the local taxing jurisdictions. We also determine values for railroad properties, pipelines, and power lines, and we determine how those values are attributed to each of their local taxing jurisdictions. Beyond those, we also do a wind energy production tax, which is not a property tax. It's a production tax on wind energy conversion systems. And those values, or those taxes, excuse me, are also distributed to the areas where those systems are located. The valuation process that assessors use at the local level is most commonly the sales comparison approach. In this approach, the estimated market value is determined by using comparable sales of properties that have sold on the open market under normal and competitive conditions. And this is what is referred to as the estimated market value, and you would see that on your notice of valuation and classification every year. These open market sales are sales where the buyer and the seller are typically motivated. They're not under any undue stresses or circumstances. The property has been exposed to the open market for a given period of time. So those are the sales that are looked at, and all properties are assessed in that same manner.
Ms. Fish, can you just clarify for the members? It's my understanding that when the assessors value sales, they are not including foreclosure sales and they're not including short sales, and that has an awful lot to do with what's been happening in the resale value, but not necessarily affecting as much the assessed value of properties.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. Typically, foreclosure sales don't meet the definitions of an open market transaction. Foreclosure sales, there is often undue stimulus on the seller to have that property sold rather quickly, especially if it is a bank sale, for example, where the bank does not want that house's inventory. It's difficult to assess the physical characteristics of a property on the date of a foreclosure sale. As you may have seen in various news articles and such, the states of these properties at the time of sale are not known to the assessor. If there is a circumstance where foreclosure or a bank sale meets the definition of an open market transaction, it can be used in the sales comparison study. But typically it is just the open market transactions.
With the number of foreclosures and short sales, it really does have an impact. There's a big disparity between where our folks are at with their market and resale value versus what their assessed value is at, because they're not counting any of those sales by Minnesota state statute. So it's having a big impact with people's perception. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, along that line, can you refresh my memory? What is the status of these 1031 sales where there's a significant tax benefit for the land purchaser? Is any of that calculated into the value?
Ms. Fish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Skoy. I'm not completely up to date on the status of 1031 sales. I know that as part of the sales study, they gathered that information on the certificate of real estate value to determine whether it was a 1031 sale, and then they can study that sale further to see if it meets the definition of an open market transaction or not. But I may need to get you more information on that directly.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fisher, can you tell me are government sales, city land sales, any government unit exempt from the comparisons also?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Howe. I do not know that offhand, but I would gladly look into that and get that answer to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. As Jason briefly touched on, the timeline for reviewing sales occurs before the actual assessment date. For the January 2nd, 2011 assessment date, the sales that are reviewed are from October of 2009 to September of 2010. They are adjusted for time and market conditions, but it does create a lag time. When property values are increasing rapidly, it's often the case that your assessed value would not be increasing at the same rate. Conversely, when most sale values are decreasing rapidly, your assessed value might not decrease at the same rate because there is that lag time, and that's something that they're working on further to perfect and make more applicable to current market standards as we move forward. As part of the sales study, assessors and the Department of Revenue work together to compare assessors' values to actual sales values of properties. This ensures uniform assessment quality and accuracy. It's the accuracy of the overall assessment. It also ensures fair valuation across the state and amongst property types. For part of the study, we do require that the sales ratio median be between 90 and 105%. The International Association of Assessing Officers does allow up to 110% on that median, but we stick with 105% or below. As again, Jason briefly touched on, it's a common misconception that values directly drive taxes. Value increases are not revenue increases for local taxing jurisdictions. The value of a given property will help determine its share of that overall levy or budget. Changes in the levies, changes in the overall tax base, the values of a single property in comparison to the changing values of other properties, and a number of other factors drive the actual change in the tax amount on a tax bill. There's not a perfect relationship. Values can increase while taxes decrease, and vice versa. Values can decrease while taxes increase. To go in a little further, we can take a look at just very briefly how these values would be distributed between different properties in a taxing jurisdiction. And this is just a made-up example of a township with a budget of $2,000 and four properties that range in value from $40,000 to $125,000. In this case, the higher value property takes up more of that share of the levy, and the lower value properties take up less. It's very simple to understand in that sense. When a property decreases in value, and here we've taken property D and decreased its value by $25,000, the township levy hasn't changed. The township has still determined that it needs a $2,000 budget. So what happens instead is a shift in the property taxes. Properties A, B, and C pay slightly more of the share, while property D pays slightly less. On the other hand, if property D's value increases, again, the levy hasn't changed. The township still needs $2,000. But because of that value increase, property D is paying more of the share of the tax burden while the other properties are paying less. Beyond determining the value of a property, the next step is to determine the classification of the property. And all property in the state is classified according to its use. There are five main property classifications: residential, agricultural, commercial. There's a class four that encompasses various commercial and seasonal properties, and then class five, all other. I believe in your packet you do have an example of the class rate table for the state of Minnesota, just running through those different property classifications. along with value, your classification and your classification rate will determine your share of the tax burden. The classification types and rates are set by the legislature. Some recent classification modifications that some of you may be familiar with are Class 4C32 for nonprofit community service-oriented organizations that make charitable contributions equal to their tax amount. Class 4C10, a seasonal restaurant on a lake. Class 4C11, marina properties. Class 4C52, manufactured home park cooperatives. And additionally, last year there was a farm entity agricultural class rate linkage provision, which didn't necessarily provide a classification, but provided a classification rate to qualifying properties. What that would have affected is the following chart that we use. This is the best example that we have of how complex Minnesota's property tax system can be. This chart is only for one classification type, and that would be an agricultural homestead. These are the questions that we ask to determine if a property meets the qualifications for an agricultural homestead. As you can see, the document that we have here says 2009 revisions. It hasn't been updated yet to include the most recent value linking provision. To be quite fair and honest, we're not entirely sure of where or how to fit that into this chart, so we haven't added that in there yet. But that last provision would have affected this chart and how we determine that classification rate.
Ms. Fish, do you have a history for us? I know you've not prepared one for today, but is it possible to have a history of where did we start with these property tax classifications and how did we get to such complexity and over what period of time has it grown so complex? My impression is that it's been recently more complex than it was in years past, and I'd like to see that trend, and I think it would help our committee to look at this. If you want to talk about a goal of tax simplification, I think you begin right here with 42 property class rates. And there is work to be done by this committee, if possible, to address this. Because the range is not really that great. If you look at it, the lowest is 0.45%. That's for the blind disabled homestead, all the way up to a high of 2%. And so there's not a lot of difference there in the outcome. And I'm sure it makes a very big difference for the taxpayer. But that's one of the areas where I hope that this committee would look to maybe some simplification. And so some history on that would be much appreciated if you could, Ms. Fish.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. We actually, Jason Nord here has worked on a document very recently that shows kind of how the classification system has grown since, I believe, 1913. And we'd be happy to provide that with you to outline how that's changed over the years. And it has increased dramatically.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Some of the more recent classifications and that agricultural value linking provision are created to address either a single property owner case or a case where property owner maybe their agricultural property doesn't fit on this chart quite right. So a modification is made to allow that person into a classification. To give you a pretty good idea of what the classifications mean then when I'm saying that that helps determine your share of the tax burden. When we look at how actual net tax capacity is distributed between properties, you can see that business properties, for example, while only 14% of the market value of the state, are 24% of the net tax. On the other end of that spectrum, farm properties are 16% of the market value, but make up 11% of the net tax capacity. In my world, I always think of it in terms of payable rather than net tax capacity. So to put a different spin on that, the commercial properties, again, at the 14% of the market value, pay 31% of the taxes. And farm properties, while 16% of the total market value, pay 7% of taxes. The final snag in this would be the special programs that are attributable to different property types in the state. This is beyond value and classification, but it does further distribute the tax burden. These different types of special programs include value deferrals or other special evaluations, special classifications, and exemptions. And those all shift taxes locally, so they do shift taxes from one property onto others. This list here does not include different state-paid items such as incentives, deferrals, refunds, and credits. Jason will get into that, but these are the items that do shift taxes at the local level. Some of the more common ones that we have are open space property, the Green Acres Value Deferral Program, the Rural Preserve Program, and an Aggregate Resources Preservation Program. Again, these are all value deferrals. The amount of value deferred, for example, under the Green Acres Program is approximately $7.2 billion, and that's about 36% of the market value that's deferred. There's a similar program, a Metro Agricultural Preserves Program, that's not a deferral. These properties in certain areas do receive the Green Acres value, but rather than a deferral of taxes, those properties have a covenant of 8 years to receive that special valuation. And this chart does show the average difference typically per acre in the metro counties. Exclusions are programs where a portion of your estimated market value is excluded from your overall taxable market value. And some of the more common types of exclusions are this old house, the disabled veterans market value exclusion, plat law, which is metro vacant platted land or non-metro vacant platted land, this old house, this old business, homestead damaged by mold and lead hazard properties. The disabled veterans exclusion is the largest on this list since it was enacted. It's always hovered around $1 billion in excluded value. To give you an example of how this would work on a given property, if you assume an agricultural homestead with an estimated market value of $360,000, and you can defer $50,000 under Green Acres and $50,000 under Rural Preserve, and also have $150,000 excluded under the disabled veterans exclusion, the taxable market value then drops to $110,000. The effect that this has on the net tax capacity then is based on both the taxable market value and the classification rate. If this were just a residential homestead property, the overall net tax capacity would be the $360,000 at a rate of 1% for a net tax capacity of $3,600. But we've assumed that this is an agricultural homestead with deferrals and exclusions. The homestead residents, if we assume that that was starting at $155,000 value, there would be $5,000 left of taxable value at a rate of 1%. The agricultural land, if we assume that that started at $205,000, would have $105,000 taxable market value at a 0.5% class rate. So the overall net tax capacity of this property is $575. So again, both the classification, the valuations, and the exclusions have changed what could be a $3,600 net tax capacity on a residential property, and this is now a $575 net tax capacity. Both valuation and classification can be appealed locally and informally with the assessor, locally and formally at local or county boards of review, which we call boards of appeal and equalization, or tax court. Enrollment in special programs may also be appealed to tax court. Finally, we'll take a brief look at exemptions. Exempt properties are completely removed from the tax base. This isn't a change in a value or a tax rate or anything like that. It's property that's completely removed from the tax base. So again, that would be a shift in taxes locally. Some very common types of property that are exempted include institutions of purely public charity, churches and church property, school property, hospitals. And then there are some more obscure exemptions, one of the more recent ones being monosloped roofs over manure pits was one that I believe it's one sentence in statute, but took a good 4 pages of a bulletin from the department on how to administer that properly. So a surprisingly difficult one. Along with classification, this is an example of types of programs, exemptions that are created to address individual properties in some cases. Recent examples include an apprenticeship training facility, as well as certain assisted living facilities.
Ms. Fish,
yes.
Can you clarify? My understanding is there's a difference between a constitutional exemption and a statutory exemption, and that the statutory exemptions have grown and definitely are impacting local property taxes because we're pulling more and more off. And I'm wondering, is the department working on a study of the trends of
these exemptions with the changes in our law to the 501c3? I know that was a lot, but if you could comment on any of that, I would appreciate it.
Sure. Madam Chair, thank you. To answer the first part of the question, yes, there are constitutional exemptions. Article 10 of Minnesota's Constitution does outline exempt properties, and those do include public property used for public purposes, school property, public cemeteries. It's a very small list, and those are incorporated in Minnesota statutes. The main statute that covers exemptions has grown to 94 subdivisions over the years, and that's just the main statute. There are other statutes that allow exemptions of property. While we don't have anything currently that outlines how those have grown over the years, that is certainly a good idea to pull some of that information together to get to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A final look at exemptions, just to cover some of the more popular or common ones, would of course be some of those constitutional exemptions, public property, which is federal, state, and local government property that's used for public purposes, schools, church property, hospitals, nonprofits, Native American lands, and jobsy property as well. The list that we have here comes from our most recent abstract of exempt properties that we receive from assessors. This is done every 6 years. They send us updates, completed updates of these abstracts. The amount reported has grown since the last abstract in 2004 by $21.6 billion. So you are correct that certainly both the number of exemptions and the total value exempted has grown over the years.
Madam Chair.
With that, I will turn it back to Jason.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fish, also land that is used for economic development, like a port agency, would be exempt for 8 years, I believe it is, by state statute, and then it goes on to tax rolls if it hasn't been sold. Can you explain, is that included in these exemptions, or is that because it eventually does come on to tax rolls, it's not included in here?
Thank you, Ms. Senator Howe, Madam Chair. I might defer to Jason on this one.
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I'm not completely fresh. It's not fresh in my mind exactly how the eight-year provision works, but I know that to the extent that the property would be exempt, it is included in these in the abstract. That we collect a data set every 6 years on exempt property. So we collected it. We just finished collecting it in 2010, and these figures are all from 2010. So we do have the 2010 reporting on the amount of economic development properties that are exempt in the state. I'm not exactly sure how that. So to the extent that that property is exempt, it would be included.
Ms. Zoff has an answer on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I remember a little bit of the history of that exemption, and the issue was that some municipalities were setting aside some land for future development, for economic development purposes, and in some cases they had held it for an extremely long period of time. So the legislature enacted a restriction on the period of time during which that could remain exempt on the theory that that would discourage cities from holding more land than they really were likely to be able to develop and get onto the tax rolls. So in that case, the year limitations came into effect, and there's a different limitation for smaller cities outside the metro area with a recognition that they might have more trouble getting those properties developed.
Madam Chair, so
Senator Howe.
If I could get the history on that, because I think so it was exempt and then we put a time limitation on it, because I think now there's a push to push it back from 8 to 15 years. I know there's some people working on that. So I'd like to get the history on that so we have a better understanding. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator and Ms. Fish and Mr. Nord, if I could go back to this slide with the exemptions on it. I have been very interested in the one the slide that talks about the charitable institutions, nonprofits, that 5,200 parcels, and the other. Now there are 22,000 parcels in the other category, and we're up to 5.3 billion in exemptions in these categories, and that's where I'd like to see that trending. And so, if your report addresses that, I think that would be very helpful. That other category doesn't tell us a whole lot about what's in there and how we got there. So any trend analysis that you have on that would be much appreciated.
Madam Chair, we can certainly send information from the exempt abstract from 2010 and 2004, so you can get a sense of how much those categories have grown. We didn't collect the prior to 2004. We didn't collect it at a greater level of detail as we do now, but we do have it as essentially by statutory reference in our current reporting, and so we can send you as much of that as you're interested in. So.
Thank you, and Mr. Norden and members. Someone with pretty good authority from the Ventura administration told me back then that there were exemptions to the tune of 30% to 35% in some of our bigger cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I'm trying to confirm if that's true. What does that look like on a jurisdictional basis, and how many of their properties are exempt from property tax, and is that having a big impact on the valuations for those that are in the non-exempt category that are actually paying property taxes? I wonder how much of that is an impact in this big conversation we're having about property taxes. To the extent that you can provide us information about that, I think it would be very helpful.
Sure. And, cool. Madam Chair, I happen to have that with me. The total exempt property in Minneapolis is about $10.8 billion. In St. Paul, it's about $8 billion. In Duluth is $1.6 billion. I don't know what percent that is of their total tax base, but we certainly have those numbers that we can send to you.
I think that would be helpful. I know, Senator Skoy, do you have a question?
Well, just a kind of a follow-up, Madam Chair. Along that same vein, you know, there are a number of rural counties that in the high percentage, 80% of the land is publicly held, which certainly has an impact on their ability to assess revenues for their operations. And, you know, all those public lands, they have to provide services to them. And so that's obviously the rationale for so, you know, part of the discussion has to revolve around that also.
Agreed, Senator. It's a good point. Thank you.
Madam Chair, then to continue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On Senator Skoy's point, should that raise the question of asking whether the state owns too much land, too much property, and that as a result, we're not gaining any revenue from it, which is hurting our cash flow?
Well,
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I think that discussion has been ongoing, certainly in the counties that have so much public land. Mm-hmm. It's kind of ongoing about it.
Yeah. It always does, Madam Chair, to come up almost every biennium, if not every year. And we sometimes get an immediate opportunity to purchase land. Perhaps it's owned by a big steel company up north, but we seem to trip over ourselves finding money to pay in cash almost for the opportunity to buy thousands of acres, and yet at the same time we take it out of our revenue stream, and as a result of the revenue stream, then we have the very same people that wanted it now are complaining that we don't have enough money for other government programs. So it's kind of a vicious cycle that we keep circling all the time, and it's just a continual thing.
Well, and Senator Limmer, I think that's one of the interesting distinctions between the constitutional exemptions and the statutory exemptions. When government owns property, it is constitutionally exempt, is my understanding, and that's what I'm trying to find out through more analysis here, but the statutory exemptions are not, and so you can look at it differently when it comes to government and that whole payment in lieu of taxes. If there's a government need to own the property, then it maybe justifies the PILT payment. But I think we should distinguish that from the other types of exemptions that take properties off of the property tax rolls. It may be a way to begin that conversation. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Fish, I'm new on the tax committee, but a simple question. How do you become designated as an institution of purely public charity? What is that exactly, and how do you get that designation?
Ms. Fish.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen. That's an excellent question. That law actually was recently updated, I believe, in 2009, outlining the qualifications to become exempt as an institution of purely public charity. The first item is that you must be a 501c3 organization as determined by the IRS. And then you have to meet a set of requirements on the type of business that you operate, whether you receive donations, what sort of charity you give, the fact that you're giving a charity, whether you restrict the beneficiaries of the charity or not. There are a number of factors, we call them, I believe there are six factors other than the 501c3 requirement that outlined based on a very old court case, North Star court case, that kind of outline what how to generally decide if something is a charity. It's a little bit subjective. There are some objective points to it. There's an application process that's reviewed by the county assessor to determine if the property qualifies for exemption under that subdivision statute.
Thank you. Senator Rosen?
No.
Senator Howe?
Madam Chair, wasn't there just a recent state Supreme Court ruling on a tax case that kind of impacted nonprofits?
Thank you, Senator Howe. If memory strikes me correctly, the most recent one that I can think of that affected a lot of nonprofits was an Under the Rainbow decision in 2007. If that is familiar to you, I believe that that case outlined the type of payments that properties could receive, and it was due to that court case that 2009 language was updated to clarify for purposes of property taxation, kind of what that all meant to prevent any unnecessary or unintended swings in the types of properties that would qualify for exemption.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And back to your question, Ms. Fish, please tell me that not all the class rates are this complicated.
Ms. Fish. Thank you, Senator Ortman and Senator Roseman. Not all of them, no. The easiest would be a residential homestead where you own a home and you live in it. But there are certainly some very complicated classifications out there.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, to continue then, the conversation we've had so far about values and tax base has been surrounding our main tax base. Most property taxes in Minnesota are levied against net tax capacity, which, as Andrea said, is the market value multiplied by the class rate. This is a unique concept to Minnesota. Other states generally don't talk in terms of a net tax capacity. They might instead refer to an assessed value. And so in Minnesota, our class rate percentages are very small that make our tax rates very large. I think originally when the net tax capacity system was adopted, it was originally meant to loosely identify kind of the ideal tax amount for a property where a normal tax rate would be about 100%, thinking that we could kind of judgments about jurisdictions as to how much or above or below 100% tax rate they might be. So this has made comparisons to other states a little bit difficult. If you take another hypothetical state that might talk in terms of assessment ratios and mill rates rather than class rates and net tax capacities, you can see a residential property of $100,000 might have the exact same tax in one other state compared to Minnesota, but their mill rate of 13 mills will look a lot smaller than Minnesota's tax rate of 114% to yield the same calculation. So in nominal terms, our rates might look higher to businesses that are looking across state, but the more important analysis in multi-state comparisons is tax burdens, and Eric will take a look at some of our VOS data and give you some information about burdens at later in this hearing. There are other tax bases, though, as Senator Skoy's question alluded to. Not all property taxes in Minnesota are levied on net tax capacity. Many taxes are also levied on referendum market value, where referendum market value is structured differently than net tax capacity. So for all Class 2 property, other than the house, garage, and first acre of a farm, and any 4C1 seasonal recreational residential property or any student housing property, the referendum market value is zero. And then for any classification of property that has a class rate of less than 1%, the referendum market value is equal to their net tax capacity times 100. And for all other classes, the referendum market value is equal to their taxable market value. So this dramatically changes the incidence of the burden of a levy. And so a levy that is distributed on referendum market value has quite different burdens than a levy that's distributed on net tax capacity. And we've kind of lost the purity of the distinction over time. There are some referenda levies that are actually levied on net tax capacity, and there are some levies that are levied on referenda market value that are not referenda levies anymore. So we've blurred those lines over the years. Minnesota, the tax bases go even beyond just net tax capacity and referendum market value. When you talk about net tax capacity levies, there's a distinction between the state net tax capacity tax base and the local net tax capacity tax base. And so you see we then start talking about three different tax bases instead of just two. And the state net tax capacity tax base is further split into the portion that is this commercial industrial state tax base and the seasonal recreational residential state tax base. So we're now up to four tax bases. And then when you insert the impact of the job zones, which provide a partial exclusion for some levies but not an exclusion for other levies, now the tax bases multiply again, and we're up to as many as six tax bases. And this is still rather simplified because there are additional tax bases that you could talk about, too. This chart summarizes the amount of the taxes that are levied on the different types of tax bases. So we have $5.8 million of levy on net tax capacity. $5.8 billion levied on net tax capacity. Referendum levies account for almost $800 million. The state general property tax levy, again, almost $800 million. The fiscal disparities, I guess, can be considered another type of tax base. There's $520 million that is distributed through the fiscal disparities program. And really, tax increment financing, captured value is also can be called a tax base by some arguments. That's almost $273 million of levy, and there's also a separate tax base for power line taxes, which is about $100,000.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Mr. Nord, what are the property taxes that are paid in the TIF district?
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, and I'll get into this a little bit more later, but essentially when the tax rates are calculated, the amount of captured value in a TIF district is excluded from calculating the rate, but then the rate is extended to that tax base, and so that's what forms the increment in a TIF district. So essentially you pretend the value isn't there when you set a rate, but then you tax it by the rate, and that's what generates the incremental revenues that fund a TIF district. So
Madam Chair, Mr. Nord, it's a calculation used to determine that increment that they're going to benefit or gain.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, yes, the way the TIF districts work is you identify what the original value of the district is when it's created, and then you compare that to the current value, and the difference, the increase in the value from when it was generated is the increment, and so that's what's essentially ignored when you calculate tax base, but then you extend the rate to that tax base and generate the increment. So.
Thank you.
So that kind of concludes the first topic of property tax policymaking, of defining your tax bases and your relationships and how burdens are distributed, initially at least. The second major area for policy consideration is levy authority. Minnesota has a state property tax levy. We grant extensive levy authority to counties, cities, towns, and school districts. There's also a large number of special taxing districts that are given levy authority, including watershed districts, HRAs, EDAs, and regional development commissions, hospital districts, sanitary sewer districts, et cetera. And there are even some sub-jurisdictional areas where taxing authority might be granted, some special service districts. There are different types of levy authority. Some levy authority is based on a referenda. Some levy authority is unlimited. Some is limited. Statutes contain limitations either by dollar or by rate or by amount. And levies essentially determine the total size of taxes that property taxpayers have to pay. So some summary information about the levies by authority. This chart shows there's about $800 million of state levy. County levies a total about $2.6 billion. Cities, $1.8 billion. Townships, $200 million. School districts, another $2.2 billion. And special taxing districts account for the $306 million. TIF districts, the $273 million.
Mr. Nord, on the special taxing districts, are all of them line itemed on the property tax statements for property owners?
Madam Chair, this was a kind of a big discussion last year a little bit that Right now, it varies a little bit, but essentially there's only room on the tax statement to show about four special taxing districts. Some counties have a little bit more room to show maybe five or six, but when we took a look at how many special taxing districts there are at most, there are some areas in Hennepin County where there may be up to nine special taxing districts, and currently there's just no room to really fit all that itemization on the property tax statement. We met, we discussed that a little bit this summer with some of the counties to talk about how feasible is it to produce a property tax statement that would itemize all the special taxing districts. And there are definitely some concerns about how feasible that is and about the amount of cost that would impose on changes to systems. So it's something that that we've had some conversation about, but currently there is some limitation to the ability to show every special taxing district on the tax statement.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
To that point, I recall this discussion, and I think in the end, with the four lines, it covered the majority of the dollars that were being assessed. There were some smaller ones that they weren't able to include, but I think the majority of the dollars being assessed were covered with those four lines.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pogomiller.
Madam Chair, I think from a historical perspective, on this chart, people should note that if you add the state levy, 147 per capita, and the school levy, 414, that's 561. The 2001 reform, that was the swap. So just kind of big picture, the state level should be considered a school number. It's not directly earmarked or directed, but that was the swap in that reform.
Senator Pogomiller, is that the statewide business property tax, and you're saying it goes into the general fund, and then we create some appropriations to schools through the school budget? K-12? Is it, or it goes into the general fund?
Yeah.
Mr. North?
Madam Chair, to give you the detail then on the special taxing districts by type, I won't read off all the numbers for you, but the majority of special taxing district levies come through the economic development oriented groups and the Met Council and the watershed districts and transit districts. The whole notion of levy authority and giving levy authority to lots of different jurisdictions, when you combine that with the fact with other features such as special service districts and sub-jurisdictional rate differences, and you examine disparity reduction aid, which I'll get to a little bit more in a moment, this results in 6,200 plus unique areas in the state where the tax rate is different. So when you add up the combination of all the jurisdictions' rates and all the rate features, and you want to know how many different tax rates there are in the state, there's about 6,200 different unique taxing areas. We collect, so just to illustrate that a little bit, if you had a Spruce County and it was split into two different school districts, and there was a watershed district that covered part of one of the school districts, and a city kind of overlapped the confluence of those districts, and we drilled in and also had a special taxing district for a downtown economic development agency. In this example, there would be five different unique taxing areas. So there's five different areas of that city where the total tax rate is different because it's made up of different jurisdictions. So we collect a lot of the data that we have, and a lot of the modeling that we do it is limited to having the data at this unique taxing area level instead of at the parcel level. So the last couple of topics in regard to levy authority, Minnesota has a unique truth in taxation process, which requires that we send out preliminary tax notices to people in the assessment year before levies are finalized and before taxes are calculated in the payable year, so that people have an opportunity to provide input and react to the proposed levies. Minnesota also employs a variety of specific and overall levy limits. And our overall levy limitations are combined or offset with various special levy exceptions. So we make exceptions for some levies that aren't subject to the overall levy limits, which creates a lot of administration And there's a tug of war between applying a strict limit and then applying exceptions. And so it's kind of a very difficult process of trying to figure out how to provide a tight levy limit and an effective levy limit and yet give people exceptions for important levy considerations. So that is kind of the nature of the levy authority in Minnesota. After you get past levying and you start calculating tax rates, there's more preferences that are included in our system, disparity reduction aid, which, again, I'll get to in a moment, and then the existence of a lot of sub-jurisdictional districts. So, like, for example, a city might be able to create a rural-urban service district. Part of the city has the urban services. Part of the city has rural services. And so they can have two separate tax rates instead of having to have one uniform tax rate. And there's a variety of other subordinate service districts. And as I mentioned earlier, when we calculate our tax rates, we don't just take the total levy and divide it by the total tax capacity. First, we subtract out from the total tax capacity. We subtract the power line set aside, the power line net tax capacity set aside that funds power line credits. We set aside the amount of contribution net tax capacity that's going to be used for the fiscal disparity program, and we set aside the TIF captured value when we calculate the tax rates. And so this allows extra revenues to be generated for power lines to pay power line credits and extra revenues for TIF tax increment financing districts. And it allows some of the levy to be moved to be calculated under a different rate under the fiscal disparity's area-wide rate. And so there's some complications in calculating tax rates. And then getting back to the disparity reduction aid, we have to calculate an initial tax rate, and then we have to apply disparity reduction aid. Disparity reduction aid is not a general purpose aid that's given to a jurisdiction. It's targeted to one of the unique taxing areas. It's based on what happened in 1988 when we went to the net tax capacity based system. Essentially, the areas in 1988 that had high tax rates were given a little bit of aid to buy down the final rate in those areas. And so we still pay that today. We've grandfathered that, and we continue to pay it every year. So we buy down the tax rate in certain UTAs based on that change that was made in 1988. So that we have a distinction between initial tax rates and local tax rates after disparity reduction aid is applied.
Mr. Nord, can you just clarify? We update formulas all the time, but that's one we've not updated since 1988. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Disparity reduction aid is a challenge, I think, for people to address, because in order to eliminate it or remove it, you're directly raising tax rates for the people who are benefiting from it. And so it's managed to hang around for a long period of time, but it doesn't necessarily bear the same relationship today as it bore back in 1988, and it is kind of a legacy program or a legacy aid that we continue to pay every year.
Mr. Nord, we just got a fiscal disparities report from the department. Is that right? Did it just come out?
Madam Chair, there was a – the fiscal disparities program is a similar name to the disparity reduction aid. They're different programs. I think there was a report that was asked of the department. That report has not been done yet. We'll be working on that this coming year. There was also a report that was asked for from the administrative auditor of the fiscal disparities program. And I think that Anoka County, who is kind of the coordinator of the fiscal disparities program, has released that report. But the additional report on fiscal disparities, the department has yet to begin. So,
Mr. Nord, I know we have members that are working on bills related to fiscal disparities. Can you, for my benefit and the others, just describe the difference briefly between the disparity reduction aid program and the fiscal disparities program?
Sure. Madam Chair, the only thing really they have in common is the word disparity. So disparity reduction aid is just that legacy aid payment that buys down the tax rate due to the conversion to net tax capacity-based taxation in 1988. The fiscal disparities program is completely different. Essentially what it does is it requires some of the tax base in the metropolitan area to be shared into a pool so that for commercial industrial properties in the metropolitan area, part of your taxes are based on your local tax rate, and part of your taxes are based on this pooled fiscal disparities rate. And so basically jurisdictions share tax base for the and it's really quite complicated, too complicated to really for me to do justice off the top of my head, but essentially tax base and levies are shared to distribute so that across the metropolitan area there it maybe hopefully isn't as much competition for precious tax base as there would be without a fiscal disparities program, but something we'll be studying in the next year or two.
Madam Chair.
Well, evening reading for members. Senator Fogelmiller.
I thought apparently disparity reduction aid is only $18 million now. Is that the only reason you end up with a local tax calculation, local tax rate?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, for the longest time, it was the only difference between the initial tax rate and the local tax rate. Recently, we've employed one other reason to do that, and that's for the correction of errors in TIF districts.
Okay.
So if there's an error in a TIF district and there needs to be a rate adjustment, we use those rate adjustments to also create local tax rates that
okay.
are different from initial rates. So.
Is that a Madam Chair?
Senator Pogelmiller.
Are those one-time phenomenon?
Madam Chair, Senator Pogelmiller, that's correct. They're generally, well, it depends on what, we try to do it over 1 year to try and limit the extent of the rate corrections. Every once in a while, if the depending on the nature of the error, it might need to be spread over a couple of years.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, to continue, so after we're done calculating tax rates, which is, we can see it hasn't been a very straightforward process. We get to the point of applying even more types of benefits and relief, and I'm not going to talk about AIDS, which Eric Ouellette presented to you last week, and I'll just briefly touch on the credits because he covered some of the credits as well. But once you have taxes calculated, there are also credits, the Senior Deferral Program, Property Tax Refunds, and the Sustainable Forest Initiative Act that are additional preferences. And again, here's just simply the chart of credits and the amount of credits that we pay. The Senior Deferral Program is for eligible senior homesteaders where they may defer a portion of their tax bill until the property is transferred. It becomes a lien on the property, and the state reimburses the counties for the amount of the deferred taxes. Right now we have 273 people participating in the program for about $840,000 of deferral for about $3,000 per homestead. Eric kind of touched on the property tax refund programs last week, too, so I won't go into these in detail. But again, there's two different types of homeowner. There's a homeowner refund, a renter refund, and then the targeted refund that is geared more towards sharp increases in your taxes, whereas the other two programs are more income tested. The Sustainable Forest Initiative Act is not specifically a property tax benefit necessarily, and it's not really a refund, but the department makes payments of the incentive payments to eligible landowners. And again, you had quite a bit of discussion on this last week. Here's some of the recent payment history, the amount that we paid per acre, the total number of claimants for each of those years, and the total amount of money we've spent each year on SFIA. The amount, again, for 2010 is limited to $5.7 million. It would have been $13.6 million if it weren't for the temporary cap of the $100,000 per claimant. And again, one of the topics that you'll be taking up, I believe, is the fact that the per acre payment jumped from the $874 to the $1567, largely as an unintended consequence due to the change in how the per acre payment is calculated. And so those, again, are things that you've already had some discussion on, and I'm sure you'll have more discussion on. Before I turn it over to Eric, there's just a couple last things I wanted to touch on. One is there's a lot of new members, new people to the committee. One of the things that immediately becomes attractive to people who are new to property taxes is the idea of putting limits, caps, or freezes in place. Words of caution, limits, caps, or freezes on values just shift taxes. And they often do so in perverse ways over time. People have been around a while and remember limited market value, remember how limited market value sounded so good, but over time built up some kind of unintended shifting of taxes that people really didn't conceive when it was first enacted. And so it's probably you can avoid some of those unintended consequences by more overtly classifying and designing your tax bases. Limits, caps, or freezes on tax amounts create gaps between what is levied and what is actually collected, and it undermines budgeting for jurisdictions and can create similar equity concerns. The limits, caps, or freezes on levies might be the best overall way to constrain tax amounts, but they also are difficult to prescribe because they can be stimulative in some cases, they can be overly restrictive, or they can be largely ineffective depending on how tight or loose they're designed. And so just some more. And we have overall levy limits in place, but they're set to expire for next year. Minnesota's property tax system is very complex. The preponderance of all these features makes Minnesota pretty uniquely complex. Some even details that we haven't talked to you about make it even more so. The fact that you can have split classifications and extensive homestead determination processes and fractional homesteads and having to link properties due to our tier breaks really makes Minnesota's system complex. And we do have, as Senator Limiter pointed out a few hearings ago, we do have the property tax working group that is examining ways to simplify the property tax system. The report is due February 1st of next year. So we are working on a lot of this, and complexity is a real issue. It does cause problems. It's not just a matter of administrative bureaucracy. It diminishes the ability of taxpayers, administrators, and policymakers to understand the system. It diminishes the transparency and accountability of the system. It leads to errors and promotes more incremental changes that exacerbate problems. It's inefficient. A lot of the expenses of the complexity are borne by the counties who have to administer the system. And again, it does lead to a lot of unintended consequences. So from here, if there aren't further questions, we'll turn it over to Eric to present to you some of the burden analysis from the VOS data.
Mr. Nord, we do have a couple of questions from members, if you don't mind. Senator Howe and then Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nord, one thing I didn't see in here was pollution control exemptions. You know, I think that's a significant burden for some of our local jurisdictions, and I know the legislative body has tried to put a Band-Aid on that by aid to utility cities, but I was just wondering if what in the state do we have, and does that fall under, does the aid fall under a tax preference because it's going to a local jurisdiction, or does the exemption fall under exemptions, or is that a preferential treatment?
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, we kind of buried it in the other because we couldn't show you every category of exemption. It is in the exemption chart under that other category. The specific total for pollution control, there's about 4,100 properties in the state for about $240 million of exemption.
So how much?
$240
million. Thank you.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's our property tax system is obviously unique. It's quite apparent. Could you give us a perspective of how unique? We have 50 states. Are we super unique? Number one, number 42, somewhere in there. Have an idea?
Sure.
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair and Senator Chamberlain, doing multi-state research is very difficult because you really have, it's so hard enough to understand our own system, let alone trying to understand everybody else's at first blush. But I will tell you that we did put together some of this information for the working group, and the best resources that we can have say, it depends on how you count Minnesota's classifications. You could say we only have five, but I would argue that we have 55 or 56. The next closest state is South Dakota with 14 classifications. There's only a handful of states that have 10 or more classifications. I'd say it's probably much more common for states to just have four, five, six classifications of property. But Minnesota is unique because of our constitution. We have our uniformity clause allows us, basically says that taxes shall be uniform on separate classes of property. That amendment was adopted in 1906 to the constitution. It was called the Weidert Amendment because it essentially gives Minnesota a lot more freedom that other states don't have to classify property and to provide for a much greater degree of classification than I think other states are free to do.
Thank you.
Mr. Nord, to follow up on that, if going back to page 13, you had the comparison of those tax bases where another state might have used a mill rate versus our tax rate. And I wanted to ask, is that
methodology, is that out of date, or are we an outlier in the way we calculate our property tax rate? And is that something we should look at following the conversation we had with our site selector, who said, you know, we've got CEOs that are looking at these different types of comparisons to determine where they might find the most business-friendly climate. Is this having an impact on folks when they look at how we calculate our property taxes?
Madam Chair, I don't know how to evaluate Minnesota to say Minnesota's better or Minnesota's worse, but I think it's that Minnesota's different, that it maybe makes it a little more difficult for people up from outside of Minnesota to immediately understand how our tax burdens compare. So really, if you're a business and you're looking at across different states for, you know, kind of location decisions, you'd want to rely on burden analysis, not just looking at rates. You know, so if someone were to just shop around based on tax rates, they would maybe look at Minnesota and say, well, Minnesota has some high tax rates, but it's because they also can't immediately understand the structure of the tax bases and all the features that are built into the system. And so really, there are a number of 50-state tax burden comparison reports that are put out there, and I think Minnesota generally falls more in the middle of the pack. We used to be much closer to the top of the list, but we've changed in the last decade as to where we sit across a lot of states. But multi-state tax comparisons can be difficult, and because Minnesota is so unique, it can be harder for maybe people to figure out exactly how our system works.
Mr. Nord, I appreciate what you just said. My question was a little bit more objective than that, though. Is there a consensus among other states about methodology, and are we an outlier, meaning we're just so different than everybody else in how we calculate it, and yet other states have come to a consensus and are more easily compared one to the other?
Madam Chair, I'd say that's safe. Minnesota is definitely unique. There's no other state that uses the same terminology that we use, the net tax capacity and really the class rates, the way we talk about them. So the other states, I think, are much more similar. There is still a fair amount of variation from state to state, where the same terms might have different meanings across states. So, but we definitely are an outlier, I think, in terms of the terminology we use and the way we've structured our property tax system.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Daley.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for this report. Your grasp of these very complex issues is impressive. You mentioned that a property tax working group is going to deliver a report 1 year from today. I'd like to know if we can get an interim update. I don't know who's in the working group. Do you perhaps know who's on that working group? And if we could talk to them and ask them to give us a report in a month, where they are in the process? I mean, sometime before 1 year from now?
Senator Daley, I think there are a couple members in this committee that serve in that work group, but I'm sure Mr. Nord can get you a list of all of them. And you said you've started preparing some information for that group. I think that's what Senator Daley's question is can you provide that same information to us without having to wait for a year?
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Daley, we've had four or five meetings so far, so we haven't gotten too far. The first couple of meetings were a lot of introductory materials such as this. We just in the last meeting have kind of dived into some of the classification issues and are looking at different scenarios to how we can condense our classification system. But we still have a lot of work to do, and the senators on the working group include Senator Limmer and Senator Scoy. And so we'd be happy to share the materials. That what we had mentioned earlier, the how the class rates have evolved since 1913 is some documentation that we put together for the last working group meeting, so we can pass that on to the members to look at. So
great, thank you, Mr. Nord. Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Willett with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to talk about a report called the Property Tax Burden Report. This report was enabled by some legislation in 2008, which allowed us to create a database where we merge property tax homestead records with income information, so we can, at the individual homestead level, better understand what property tax burdens are as a share of income. The report that is in your packet is the second annual report that we've done. It's based on 2008 property taxes. It does take us a while to compile the income data, especially, so that's why there's a bit of a lag here. And I'll just mention up front that the property tax world and income world have changed quite a bit since 2008. So just keep in mind when you're seeing the results that where people's income is at today and where people's property taxes are at today may not be exactly the same as where they were at in 2008. One other note on this. This is the this measures the direct impact of property taxes on homesteads. Some of you may be familiar with the department's tax incidence study. That measures both the direct taxes that people pay and the indirect impact of taxes that businesses pay that are passed along to consumers. So this is a narrower part. This is the tax bill that's directly paid by the homestead. It doesn't include those secondary impacts of business taxation. Before I dive into the results, I always like to show this slide to help, to just remind members that why property taxes might be different from one place to another. There's a lot of reasons, and Jason and Andrea alluded to some of these, but I just wanted to touch on them quickly. The level of public service varies a lot from one part of the state to another. In a rural area with a lot of townships or unorganized territories, there's going to be less total public services paid for through property taxes. So because of that, tax burdens might be a little bit lower. Similarly, school referenda levies vary significantly across the state, and those have a very big impact on the ultimate tax burden for homesteads. And community preferences vary from one community to another. So the basket of goods that's being paid for locally through the property tax and other sources varies a lot from one area to the next. Intergovernmental aid and other non-property tax resources also vary from cities, between cities and townships, among jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions rely more heavily on special assessments or fee revenues. Others rely more heavily on the property tax. Some get direct federal aid. Many do not. State aids are not uniform statewide, so those also have an impact on property tax burdens. Tax-based composition is a really important determinant of homestead tax bases. In those communities that have a great share of their tax base in non-homestead property, think of the resort areas up north, the power plant cities, places that have a large industrial base, farm communities where the bulk of the value is in agricultural land, the homesteads may pay a lower proportion of the total taxes. And we're just looking at the homestead tax burden. So a low homestead tax burden may not necessarily mean that there's low taxes in that area. It may just be that there's other properties that are picking up the lion's share of the taxes. And finally, eligibility for property tax refunds, credits, and exclusions, the sorts of things that Jason and Andrea were talking about, vary from one property to another and one jurisdiction to another. And those can have a significant impact on the ultimate burden for a homestead. The first chart I'd like to show you is one of the most important ways to sum up the report. This shows tax burden by income, by income ranges of homesteaders, and the impacts of the market value homestead credit and the property tax refund on that incidence. And again, this is the direct taxes paid. This doesn't include the indirect shifting of business taxes. So these numbers will be different than what's in the tax incidence study. But I think this chart shows a couple of different things. If your eye moves from the top to the bottom, this reminds us that the property tax is a regressive tax and that people in higher income ranges generally pay a lower share of their income in property taxes than people with lower incomes. And this is homesteaders only. If you move from left to right across the page, you see the impact of the market value homestead credit and the property tax refund program on the ultimate incidence of the property tax. Both the market value homestead credit and the property tax refund do reduce the regressivity of our property tax system. The property tax refund, because it is income tested, is a little bit more effective in reducing the regressivity of the system. But if you see without those two programs, those in the lower income range of $10,000 to $30,000 would have twice as high of a median burden, 7.6 instead of 3.8, whereas there's virtually no impact at the highest income levels of those two programs. So the range from top to bottom without those two programs is 7.6% to 1.9% of income for the wealthiest, whereas after those two programs, the relationship is only 3.8 to 1.8. So that top-to-bottom relationship gets a whole lot closer between the lower income and the higher income people because of these two programs. We separately look at the agricultural homesteads.
The last column.
I'm sorry, Senator Pogliano.
The last column is both. The effect of both.
Mr. Ouellette.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Senator Pogliano. The last column is the net taxes after both those programs.
Correct. Thank you.
We look at agricultural homesteads separately because they are taxed differently than residential homesteads in terms of the amount of land that qualifies for the property tax refund. So we did them as a separate analysis, and you see the results here. The property tax refund is, and we haven't been able to incorporate the market value credit in this chart, but the final column does include the impact of both of them. We just haven't been able to isolate the impact of the market value credit. Similarly, taxes are lower as a percent of income with higher income agricultural homesteads, and the PTR has a bigger impact at the lowest income levels. Medians are really important, but distribution is important too. And the next slide shows the percent of homesteaders in various regions that have an income greater than 5%, have a property tax burden of greater than 5% of their income. The darker bars show the numbers before property tax refund, and the gray bars show the impact after property tax refund. So what you'll see here is that there's a measurable share of homesteaders that have the very high income, that is over 5% in all across the state, bigger proportions in the metropolitan area than in greater Minnesota. But throughout the state, the property tax refund is very important in reducing the number of homesteads that have that 5% or higher burden. And finally, a map of the state by region. These generally follow the economic development regions in greater Minnesota, although we've combined a couple to get the same number of, roughly the same number of homesteads in each region. This shows the median burden by region across the state. And remember those reasons that the burdens might vary that I mentioned at the beginning of my time. A lot of the areas that have the lowest burdens also have the most township or unorganized areas. They have the lowest proportion of homesteads. Homestead value as a proportion of the total. But having said that, the burdens are generally higher in the metro area than they are in greater Minnesota, the highest median burden being in the city of Minneapolis and the lowest being in the southwestern corner of the state. This is the second year we've done this chart, and the numbers have changed a little bit, but the rough relationship among regions has remained consistent. There's a lot more information in the 61-page report that I think is in your packet. It's on our website if it's not. And for those members of the public, they can get it on our website under publications and then research on our website.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach and then Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ouellette, to what extent does these percentages of tax versus income To what extent are they impacted by school voter-proof school levies? I mean, a lot of these districts in these rural areas have relatively low tax capacity. What they have maybe isn't taxed or is seasonal rec, or so there's not a big school portion. Do we know kind of are the numbers skewed a little bit by the school issue in the metro area? There's more commercial real estate, so they have, I think, generally have higher school levies. To what extent are the school levies play into these numbers?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, we think that's a pretty important determinant. We have not taken this report to the next step and tried to parse out the why of the burdens. That's why I showed that slide that listed the many factors. That is one of the very important factors. To this point, we haven't had the resources to really dig in and isolate what's differences in school levies versus city levies versus county levies, what's because of other parts of the tax base paying more of the share, what's the spending difference, all that. It would be a fascinating research project. It's something we haven't been able to do to date. But I think it is really important when you look at this map to remember those determinants, and that's why that slide, a couple slides earlier, lists the main reasons we can think of why there's going to be variation from one area to the next.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Mr. Well, could you go back to the slide and just explain a little bit clearer on the burden greater than 5% of income homestead with income over 10K. What you're looking at on that graph is without the PTR, 35% of the homes are spending more than 5% of their income.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, that's correct. In the city of Minneapolis, more than 35% of homesteaders, if there was no PTR program and everything else remained the same, would be paying more than 5% of their income in property taxes.
Okay. And is that the number we should be looking at, is the 5%? How does that change when you go to 6% or 7%? Or do we have a range there?
I believe there's a table in the report towards the end that has a distribution of burdens by some ranges that helps answer that question. There's no magic to 5%. Okay. That just seemed like a threshold that would seem high to people, and we wanted to be able to visualize something that wasn't just the median so people knew that there were extremes that go well beyond whatever the median is. But if you carve it at different places, there's going to be – these numbers are going to vary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Rath.
Madam Chair and Senator Howe and Mr. Willett, I thought that was at some point related to the general recommendations coming from the economists or people who look into these issues, that people generally, to be economically stable, should not be spending more than 30% of their income to pay for their housing, and so that it's not unrelated to that, rather than being a total arbitrary number. Now, some people obviously do pay more, and some pay a lot less, but I thought that number at least had some indirect connection with the general recommendation that you don't pay more than 30% of your income for housing of any kind, whether it's rental or homestead, and then there's an extrapolation that gets to, well, how much of that burden of total housing costs is not mortgage and interest or insurance, but indeed property taxes.
Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, that is part of our discussion. Unfortunately, the VOS database does not allow us to identify who's still paying a mortgage and what their financing terms are. So we can't really, on a parcel level, do that calculation. But, yeah, that is taxes plus other housing costs. There is some literature on you know, a threshold to use for being overburdened.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Willett. All right, Mr. Willett, thank you. Senator
Skoy. I'm sorry. Mr. Willett, I'm struggling with the math on this, because if you had the average that all of those Minneapolis residents pay at 7.6% PTR, that was the average. How does only 35% get over 5%? That somehow doesn't seem to work out mathematically to me.
Where did the 7?
Well, you showed that graph that had the. And go back a little. One more now. There, 10,000 to 330,000. 7.6% of their what are we relating that graph to that table, to that later graph, or is that not related at all?
To this table,
yes.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, these are the medians, so the household in the middle in each of these income ranges. There are It's not a smooth distribution. There's a lot of people at the very high end, so there's a big proportion in some jurisdictions that are very much higher than what the median is, and that's what we were trying to show with this graph. If we did this table just for Minneapolis, these numbers would all be higher than they are for the statewide averages, because typically burdens are higher. But still, in the report, we do use a graph called a histogram that shows the distribution by ranges, so you can kind of see the shape of the distribution. And on the burden one, there's a lot of big tails on the right side, where there's a lot of people with an extreme burden. It's not as smooth, what we call a normal distribution in statistical terms. So that's what we're trying to show in the in that.
Thank you. I'll have to think about what's going on.
Well, and Mr. Willett, maybe you can just clarify. When you say tax burden, it's just how much of their income is going to pay for property taxes. Is that right? There's no further analysis in terms of burden.
Madam Chair, yeah, when we use the term burden, we are simply identifying how much am I paying in direct homeowner property taxes and what is that as a share of my homesteader income. Yep.
Thank you. Other questions from Mr. Roulette? Mr. Roulette, thank you so much for being here. And Ms. Fish and Mr. Nord, we appreciate your presentation. Tomorrow, members, we are going to have a hearing about our tax conformities. The Department of Revenue will be here to talk about the 2010 and 2011 tax conformity provisions that have come out of the federal legislation, so we can consider them and talk about how much they're going to cost, because they're very expensive, and we'll take them up tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have comparisons along with the Finance Committee of our taxes as compared to other states, and also our budget as compared to other states. So Wednesday and Thursday. And then we may have a shorter week next week. May only have, right now we have just one hearing scheduled for next week. Senator Bach.
Senator Ortman, I haven't looked at Senate File 60 to see how many conformity measures are included in that, but are some of the conformity measures that we're going to hear about tomorrow included, were they included in the Finance Committee and the Senate File 60?
Senator Bach, the Department of Revenue will be prepared to talk about all of them tomorrow, and so if you have questions about those in Senate File 60, they'll be prepared. They will be bringing the information forward for all of them.
Well, my question is, are some of the provisions in Senate File 60 already in the bill on the floor, and we're going to get our chance to hear them tomorrow?
Senator Bach, yes. Okay. We've heard them once. We can hear them again tomorrow. If there are no other questions or business before the committee, we're adjourned.